Okay, well, thank you. I think the gauntlet has been laid down on both sides. But I think before we take questions from the audience, I just want to give Chris and Frank a quick chance to respond, if you guys would like to any of the things that Don and Dick just said.
Chris? Too much talent in this room for me to say more. I'd just soon throw it open.
All right.
I wanted to. I just had to say, if OIRA is keeping the analytical integrity, are they keeping it in an undisclosed location here?
The answer is that whatever the analysis is, when the president or the chief of staff says, off we go in this direction, that's where OIRA goes.
And I just wanted to say on the stated preference question that Richard raised that certainly it depends on the context, and that's why it's important to deliberate in the context of the actual regulation. I think the fact that answers to valuation questions are completely context dependent is the reason why slicing and dicing and coming up with a narrowly defined question for valuation so often fails.
Okay. Do we have any questions, comments from the audience? Oh, everyone was silenced by all of that. I don't think it's on.
You mentioned that agencies often make a decision and look for the analytical support. Would you say the same is true, particularly with regard to direction from the White House to OIRA, that OIRA gets direction from the White House and then looks for analytical support?
You know, it's hard to order, it's hard to describe causes and effects in the White House environment. I would say that right now what OIRA is going through is trying to find out what the new administration's point of view is, what their directions are. The equivalent of the circular that the budget side issues to agencies in the spring for what the basic guidelines for the budget are. They're trying to find out, and the new administration, in spite of the breadth of its interests, still basically has no idea in many areas what its policies are, and it's going to take a while for it to figure those out. So the process is a circular one, similar at agencies.
Yeah.
Darius Seven.
You know, I think it would be really great just in terms of fostering the discussion throughout the day if you could say your name right before you ask your question.
Darius Sivan, United Auto Workers. When I studied economics at the University of Chicago, I encountered something called rational ignorance theory, which says that if it takes too much time or other resources to find out information, people won't find out that information. I would suggest that agencies that devote limited resources to promulgating regulations that are consistent with their missions, rather than analyzing the costs and benefits, are rationally ignorant.
Any responses from our panelists?
I guess I'd only add that I just was discussing with Curtis, who was our last questioner, the latest GAO report about OIRA review and how agencies regulate, and there's how much of the ignorance is rational and how much is irrational might be debatable. The extent of the ignorance is absolutely amazing. If you ask any agency, as GAO did, how much resources have you devoted to this, that, or the other rulemaking, the answer of every agency is, we have no idea. They don't know what they're doing, what they're putting their resources into. They really are utterly clueless about that. One other point about the role of OIRA. I don't understand why so much emphasis is put on OIRA. OIRA strikes me as a horrible entity to use to try to prod more regulation. They're all wrong for that. I mean, Bill Clinton did a whole lot of that as Justice Kagan. Oh, I slipped. I'm sorry. Solicitor Kagan pointed out in her, she was then Dean Kagan, article. Bill Clinton did a ton of that kind of thing, but he didn't rely on OIRA to do it. He relied on all sorts of other, you know, subject matter agencies and other parts of the government. Also, everybody ought to read, if they haven't already, the Bressman and Vanderbilt piece that points out that there are 19 offices in the White House that routinely get involved in major regulatory decision making, and that there's only one we know about. The others do it all under the table, and in the case of all important actions, they're far more influential than OIRA. OIRA is just this little tiny agency that has this one, I think, important but really narrow role.
I just want to say that OIRA operates underneath the table, too.
I want to say something about rational ignorance. I'm not sure if this was an implication of your question or not, but the pragmatic approach that I think would be better than our current approach, I tried to make this clear in my opening remarks, would not ignore costs and benefits. Okay? Let me say that again. Would not ignore costs and benefits. What it would decline to do is monetize the health effects benefits. They're just enormous problems that will be the subject of several panels with respect to that enterprise. But let me just say that the result of that enterprise, when it's conducted, is to drive the impact analysis into a rarefied atmosphere of technical, methodological critique, as to which 99.99% of the American population, including me, is unable to participate because we don't have the training and the expertise, and we don't have the PhDs or the masters, or we haven't taken the time to unpack everything that's going on in one of these analyses, which, let me just, I recommend Ricky's book, I recommend the RFF book, to get under the hood of just one or two of these significant cost-benefit analyses in the health and safety area to understand the magnitude of the arbitrary decisions that are being made that then produce a number, and people then debate the number. I'll just give you one example, and this is from a friend of cost-benefit analysis. It's Nat Cohane's chapter on the Clean Air Interstate Rule cost-benefit analysis. One of those obstructive CBAs, because the EPA cannot take costs into account in setting ambient standards, and it said it wasn't taking costs into account in a cost-benefit sense in doing the Clean Air Interstate Rule. But it prepared an analysis. One dimension of that analysis was to figure out how to spread the health benefits to be anticipated from the rule over a 10-year period. It turns out that how you do this makes a difference of more than two orders of magnitude in the benefits. And the decision that EPA reached and OMB approved is described by Nat, an economist, as arbitrary. And he says, but any decision would be arbitrary. There was no way to do that wasn't arbitrary, that was grounded in some kind of consensus analysis as to what the proper spread of those lagged benefits ought to be. That's just one element in that cost-benefit picture. And look at his chapter, look at other work that have been unpacking the problems, the technical problems, which we'll go into more this afternoon. I tried to focus precisely on a little different dimension of this problem, which is precisely the rational ignorance problem. I think that driving the analysis into this rarefied room where very few people can play reduces regulatory impact analysis to an intellectual exercise that is conducted by a remarkably small number of people, not including the thousands and millions of people who are going to be affected by the decision that the agency ultimately makes. That's the gravamen of the objection that I was trying to bring home this morning, quite apart and independent from all of the other objections that one could make to the process. I just wanted to focus on that one.
Let me just say that this might also be anticipating things this afternoon, but I think the unexamined premise of the argument for cost-benefit analysis and for this kind of careful review of agency decisions is the notion that we are facing enormous unaffordable costs if we don't restrain these, spendthrift agencies. And study after study shows that there aren't any such costs. Climate policy may actually involve a different order of magnitude of costs. Regulations other than that simply do not involve that. I mean, again and again, you hear these claims that regulation is going to destroy the economy, and actually, right now, the economy is sort of destroyed, but I don't think anybody thinks the Clean Air Act did it. My favorite example of the rational ignorance point is the arsenic debate, where we had millions of dollars, many person years spent on topics like, can lawyers and lobbyists come up with good estimates of the slope of the dose response curve? The same exact result would have been achieved by the following procedure. Send someone to the library for the afternoon to find out what the World Health Organization recommends and what most of the world has done. Because after all those millions of dollars and multiple person years of debates, that's what we did.
Ricky.
Chris, I wonder if you could get a little more specific about the contours of what you call pragmatic, the sort of pragmatic approach, and explain how you would make a decision about whether a standard should be set at a 1 in 1 million probability of lifetime of death from lifetime exposure to contaminant, or at a 1 in 100,000 probability of death from lifetime exposure to the same contaminant.
What a pragmatic analysis would resemble more than the current product is something like just to draw on my own training, a bench memo that would be prepared for a judge that elucidated the issues that were at stake in the decision, the positions that people had taken on one side or another of various of the contended points, and try to highlight those by reference to what we know, and I don't want to mislead anybody into thinking that the exposure and incident assessments that the medical side of this activity has to perform are free from problems as well. I mean, trying to get down to 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 1 million risk on the basis of using mouse models and laboratory experiments where you're using maximum survivable dosages and then extrapolating to human beings is itself an enterprise fraught with uncertainties. But after the discursive picture of what was at stake was laid out, the judgment, and we're not talking in the context of a specific statute now, but what an agency might do if it was trying to make a judgment with a maximum amount of discretion, I think the judgment has to come down to a political in the best sense of that word, that is trying to reflect the soundest understanding of what you think the best outcome ought to be for the society in which we currently live, that doesn't hide behind an economically derived arbitrary number and doesn't hide behind a health figure and say the science made me do it, but reflects the fact that a judgment has to be made. I have my own personal private answer as to whether 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 100,000 is a better place to end up, but I don't pretend to have a number that is suitable for prime time as a matter of public policy. But I think you have to make these decisions acknowledging that there's a social judgment that we need to make. I don't know where the American people are. I don't know where the Congress is on these issues. I always think more safety is better. So I'd probably be leaning towards the end of wanting the lowest possible number, and you'd have to talk me out of it. So that would be my bias in a regulatory environment. I wouldn't fix on the cost-benefit point, But I'd be more inclined to say, well, what can we get with available technology? And is that satisfactory? Or do we need an R&D program to try to improve the processes by which some manufacturing output is achieved to try to do better? To widen the discussion so that it doesn't focus on a static decision that's predicated on numbers that I think obscure much more than they illuminate.
I think there's no reason to think that there's a consistent number. The risks exist in contexts where you have different judgments of different risks. One of the things I discovered when we were writing Priceless, that at that time there was numerically identical risk, coincidentally, for working in the construction industry and for engaging in downhill skiing. There's one death per 2 million person days in both activities. I think it would be outrageous if that was taken as a basis for thinking that we had an equal regulatory duty to protect construction workers and to protect downhill skiers. They're completely different contexts. One is a voluntary recreation and the other is not.
In the back there.
It's Peter Strauss. It was aspiring Professor Kagan. Not yet Dean Kagan, and the interesting feature about that was that she had come from the Domestic Policy Council, and she didn't mention OIRA hardly at all in her discussion of the impact of White House guidance on agency rulemaking. What seems to me reasonably clear, hearing the discussion, is that what Chris and Frank are arguing for is, shall we say, political rather than expert judgment, often. That these really are political issues, they deserve to be ventilated in a way that will permit political decision, rather than pretend that they are objectifiable and can simply be done on the basis of calculation. And I take it that's the point as well about Dr. Spock. Mr. Spock, sorry. So I want you to relate that, if you can, to the common stuff, which is in part your downhill skier worker comparison, about human heuristics and the judgment of the voters of California just a short while ago to impose on the state an outcome, political outcome, that condemns education in that state, along with a bunch of other things, for the foreseeable future. That is, what are the risks we would take in committing these judgments to political process, and how, if at all, do we protect ourselves against them?
People can certainly make wrong judgments. I think there's nobody who thinks that the American people made the right judgment in all the last few presidential elections, whichever ones you think were right or wrong.
Go ahead. I was just actually going to try and extend Peter's question to another context. I wrote an article in 1979, and I began with, what would the world look like today if the best-selling movie of 1977 had been named Belts instead of Jaws? And we had all this dramatic music where people are being rent apart in automobile accidents because they're not wearing seat belts. At the time, everybody had access to seat belts, and only 13.6% of the population chose to wear them because they felt it was an infringement on their freedom. At the same time, there was a 40% decline in people going to beach resorts because of the literally one in God knows how many billion risk that you're going to be eaten by a shark. There's got to be some tempering of democracy in this process, or we'll go absolutely nuts.
Well, gee, I certainly agree with that. There does have to be some tempering of democracy. But we're not about to go to a system of national plebiscites on every regulatory decision. It seems to me we've got the pendulum way swung over in one direction, and I think it's appropriate to sound just a mild voice for a little bit more democratic involvement in some of our thinking about health and safety problems, which have been around for a while. They're not going away anytime soon. New ones occur on the horizon all the time. And I'm inclined to the view that what has come to dominate the regulatory impact analysis activity space in this town and around the people who make a living interacting with this town is almost hermetically sealed from reasonable understanding by anybody who doesn't have the time to devote a major block of their intellectual resources to understanding it. And not for much gain, because the discipline that's being pursued is so loaded with arbitrary assumptions and inferences and gap-filling measures. I hear the argument all the time, well, at least we should have some consistent methodology that everybody can follow, so even if we're comparing irrelevant numbers to irrelevant numbers, they're on the same scale. But there is no consistency across agencies, despite OIRA's efforts. All these cost-benefit decisions have their idiosyncrasies. And so as a consequence, there's very little ownership of what's going on in these decisions. And I'm not an advocate, as I say, for swinging over to the other side and saying, you know, provide a thumbnail's worth of information to people and have them vote on it, and that'll be our health and safety rule.
When I hear it described as a more coherent process, presenting the American consumer with, all right, it'll cost you $3 a month more on your electric bill, but that'll save 4 million fish, I'm uncertain that that would produce more coherent outcomes.
Ricky.
Sat through. And for the following reason, as Chris acknowledged, there's a lot of uncertainty in the risk assessment data as well, and I think most people would agree that there's more uncertainty in the risk assessment data than in the economic valuations. So when we were told, well, we'll sort of figure out how many fish are going to be destroyed and what the social consequences are and so on, and we can't really put a number on that because the number is hugely uncertain, we have to say we have no clue how many fish are going to be destroyed either. We don't know that either because that comes from the risk assessment data. So the result is we don't know anything. So then there are two things that we can do. One is we can try to learn as much as we can about all of these things, the risk assessments, evaluations, and so on. The second thing is we all go home. And now, because we as professionals have nothing to offer to this, and we decide that all these things should be set at random or whatever way the politicians decide to do it with no background information or anything else. And I understand what I'm saying is a caricature of what was said, but I think only a very slight caricature of what was said.
Can I jump in here?
Chris, would you like to respond to that characterization of your analysis?
Well, yeah, I'm puzzled by it, I must say. I mean, so we concede the point that there's a lot of uncertainty in risk assessments. So the way to improve that is to add more uncertainty by monetizing those figures? I don't understand that. I just don't understand that as a coherent position. There's no doubt that we need to study things harder and learn more about the physical consequences of our human actions and the anticipated consequences of regulatory decisions. And that we ought to. So professionals involved in those activities ought to rest assured that there'll be lots of work and opportunities for professional advancement. But to go from the idea that I think the move to monetizing those uncertainties is not worth doing to the kind of know-nothing position as being the one that a pragmatic approach would ultimately devolve into, I just find that hard. I don't understand how that move was made. Now, the other thing I want to say is uncertainty is always going to be with us. We all deal with uncertainty every day in decisions we make. The fact that there is uncertainty in the decisions we make does not mean that our decisions are irrational. It means we try to cope. We don't pin all our hopes, if we're wise, on one decision. We anticipate we're going to have to adjust it as we go along. We make mistakes and we learn from them. Society functions more or less the same way. We just pretend to a certain amount of numerical purity by conducting these cost-benefit analyses. But we're kidding ourselves. We don't. That number that is produced in an analysis isn't any better founded than a lot of guesses that people make, oftentimes. Now, sometimes it's not. I mean, for instance, there are some benefits that are provided as a consequence of environment regulation that you could say would largely be commodifiable. I mean, if you had a power plant that was in training a type of commercial fish, and the only impacts that you could discern was that, you could calculate the market value of the commercial fish that were being entrained. That's a respectable, plausible move, because there's a reliable market there for that commodity, and you're not implicating other subtler values or human health effects and so on. Pragmatic analysis would have no objection to doing that, would want to do that. But it does, I think, picking up on Frank's point, it wants to be more contextual and less driven to a single template for monetization than the current system.
Frank, I just want to let Don, did you have something you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that sort of talking about this by talking about the extremes is interesting, but in the daily life that I experienced anyway, this attempt to marry more knowledge and more information and some sort of a clear methodology with the political need for the decision makers to pull in a lot of other values that have been mentioned was in fact part of what went on in the White House decision-making process. And it's also what goes on in the agencies between the offices and the lawyers and then the political people at the top. So that does occur. So I think we're talking about how to refine the way that we get information. Since EO12866 was written, OIRA administrators have generally agreed, although it's been sort of lost in the argument, that the degree of analysis needs to be commensurate with the rule. And certainly in your average significant rule, the other 520 or so that OIRA looks at, and then the thousands of others, there is a much more fluid and flexible type of analysis that isn't, I don't think, all that much different than what's being described.
I want to say the last question seemed to me to conflate the information that we don't have about risk analysis and the information we don't have about monetary valuation, and these are completely different questions. I think we do know something about the number of fish that are killed by power plant cooling water intake, and it's a researchable question. Biologists, people observing what happens in the river, produce empirical data from which you can tell whether answers are right or not. The question of what is the existence value of an aquatic ecosystem is not a question which is subject to empirical research. How do you know if you got the right answer? How do you know if you're off by orders of magnitude because of the way somebody formulated the question? It's a closed inquiry in which you can only find it out by asking other questions about other hypotheses about what it means to people. I think that the really important question about the uncertainties of risk analysis, the work by Martin Weitzman, which I was somewhat referring to in terms of when you have unbounded risks and limited information, Weitzman's economic analysis is one of the very important things that's come out in climate economics lately. Says you really have to act as if it's essentially an infinite risk from which you recover a very strong form of the precautionary approach. But the risk that we don't know how many fish are killed by power plants, I mean, that's so much more manageable than anything else we're looking at.
Well, I see a lot of hands up in the room, but my job is to be the timekeeper, and I do want to keep us on schedule today. Despite Ricky's comment that this is so dispiriting, I have to say I think it was a very interesting discussion. It does seem like the debate is alive and well. Maybe if you're dispirited by that, so be it. But I want to thank our panelists for a really interesting discussion and for all of you in the audience. And we'll take a 15-minute break and then come back for the next panel. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Yeah? I shouldn't have been here. I'll just fix it.